This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you make it out to Boston Common on this Memorial Day, you'll see the green pocked by 20,000 small flags, each representing a Massachusetts soldier killed in conflict since World War I. 134 of them stand for men and women killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Their names were read aloud Thursday.
Corporal Donald E. Fisher II, Gunnery Sergeant Aaliyah P. Fontecchio, Lance Corporal Michael L. Ford.
I just think it was a very nice ceremony, but it's hard.
Dolly Sullivan of Princeton, Massachusetts, lost her son, Captain Christopher Sullivan, to a roadside bomb in Baghdad in 2005. She drove into Boston to help plant flags.
This is like when you go to D.C. and you see the Vietnam Wall. It's probably one of the more moving memorials because it just goes on and on and on with names. And I think for people in this area to look and think that each one of those flags is just someone from Massachusetts, never mind the other states, just Massachusetts, hopefully will make them pause and give thought.
Today on Radio Boston, we're taking a moment to pause and remember. We'll talk with Yarmouth Police Lieutenant Steve Ixaros, whose son Nick was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. He'll tell us how meeting with President Obama factored into his grieving process. Also, after 66 years in a boulder field in Corsica, the remains of one World War II soldier have been laid to rest in his hometown of Carver. But first today, the story of Private First Class John Hart of Bedford, Massachusetts. He was just 20 years old when he died early in the Iraq War on October 18, 2003. And despite John's early death, he was likely responsible for saving the lives of countless others after he warned his father that many of the troops were fighting without sufficient armor or protection. Back in the United States, his parents, Brian and Alma Hart, got to work. And as a result of their persistent activism over many years, millions of dollars were secured to properly protect troops and armor vehicles. The Harts are with me now to share their story and to remember their son, John. Brian and Alma, welcome to Radio Boston. And if I can just start by asking you, John entered Iraq in late 2003, but if I understand correctly, it was sometime earlier that year when he first told you that something just didn't feel right.
He called me in that summer from Italy, all concerned because they had run out of ammunition to sight their weapons. And literally, they were sent in with body plates and with unsighted weapons because the U.S. Army had run out of ammunition in Europe, apparently.
If they had already been facing equipment shortages before they'd even been deployed into Iraq, did he share with you that he was feeling just that much less safe in the middle of a war zone?
He called us what turned out to be the night his colonel had been wounded, and John had been involved with, I think, evacuating him. And after a lengthy conversation, he was whispering in the phone and he asked to talk to me. And he said that he didn't want to be overheard, but they were desperate for any kind of armor and that they were getting ambushed. And he said, "I'm going to be killed on this road." And a week later to the day, he in fact was. So that leaves families like ours with a haunting memory and a realization that I think we in the country had let down a number of excellent soldiers in that first year or two. And we continued to do that as a country for several years to come.
Mm-hmm. You said that after that phone call, when he was telling you, when John was telling you about the concerns that he had about not having vehicles, is that correct? About not having Humvees that were appropriately armored?
Well, they didn't have doors on them. Forgetting anything about armor, they were literally cloth-sided doors and open tops at the time. And a third of the soldiers in Iraq did not even have plates in their armor.
Body armor.
Correct. And I know now What I didn't know then was that there were fewer than 225 armored Humvees in all of Iraq. I mean, we had over 30,000 vehicles there, and they just weren't armored.
Can you tell us what happened on the day that John died?
He was south of Kirkuk, and on the evening of the 18th, there were three vehicles at a safe house in Taza, south of Kirkuk, and the Kirkuk air base was attacked by rockets. And so a three-vehicle convoy went out in search of the rocket site, which in retrospect was not a smart idea. But they went helter-skelter through an agricultural area along a concrete canal with a 10-foot berm on the side. And the enlisted personnel in the second vehicle saw an ambush ahead, and the convoy continued into it, and the first vehicle went about a mile through the ambush with rocket-propelled grenades and machine guns from the insurgents on the side of the canal and the berm, and they left. And the second vehicle navigated the turn, and it makes like a 90-degree turn, and then they left. And the gunner there in the second vehicle saw John and his in the last vehicle, there was John, a guy named Chris Williams, Joshua Sams, and Lieutenant David Bernstein. They got caught in the ambush and were left behind. John, in that period on the road, was shot in the neck and died. A week later, a priest and a policeman and an army colonel showed up at our door and early Sunday morning to let us know that John had been killed.
Alma, do you mind if I ask you, because I understand that, as Brian had mentioned, a commander also wrote to you and said that when John died, all his ammunition had been spent, and that your son gave everything he had for the safety of others. That sounds like John to you.
Yes, that does. John forged his reputation first month freshman high school of beating up one of the bullies, and that was him.
Yeah,
that was John.
That was John.
He would never have thought of covering himself. He would have taken care of the other guys.
I have to wonder. I mean, I remember in the very early days, around this time of the Iraq War, then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld very famously said, you quote, go to war with the army that you have. That ended up meaning without armored Humvees, without body armor, as you were mentioning. So when John became a direct casualty of, I guess, what that kind of that kind of thinking, what was your reaction to that?
The day we buried John, we met with Senator Kennedy and his staff at our request at the administrator's office at Arlington. And we told Senator Kennedy exactly what had transpired and that we had confirmation that these shortages were occurring. And he told us he would look into it. And we walked out of there wondering whether he would in fact do that or not. And we went to John's funeral. I mean, we buried John. In Section 60. So a few weeks later, in fact, Senator Kennedy and Senator Warner called the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing and had alerted the generals he was going to ask about these issues. And that's when it came out that a third of the soldiers didn't have body armor and that there were almost no armored vehicles in Iraq. And by that time, there were 400 out of roughly 35,000.
And Brian, in fact, we've got a little bit of tape from those hearings that Senator Kennedy held at the Senate Armed Services Committee. Here he is addressing some of the military brass who you were mentioning, really confronting them on that terrible shortage of armored vehicles.
Last week, when I was out at Arlington for Private First Class Hart's burial, the parents said, if you can do anything to make sure that other soldiers are over there, are not put in the kind of danger that my son was put in and lost. That would be the best thing that we could ever think of in terms of our son.
So Brian, I mean, that was from the hearings, but then there were months of lobbying that had to follow, and you did that with the help of Senator Kennedy, and eventually succeeded in getting more armored vehicles, more armored Humvees into Iraq. How did you make that happen?
The generals told Congress in that hearing that the plants were running 24/7 full out, but we couldn't figure out why they could only produce about 85 vehicles a month. So we started to collect sources in Indiana and Ohio, and we made a connection with a reporter at the Indy Star, and I also talked to the labor union guys. And we found out that they were waiting for the purchase orders. The purchase orders hadn't come. So while the Congress was being told the plant was running 24/7, in fact, it was sitting almost idle. And so I placed a phone call and got through to Jack Murtha, who, for all of his faults, really cared about frontline soldiers and had a very profane and heated conversation with him, where he said, I am appropriations, and I said, you're not sending enough money there, that they're holding back on the funds. That's why the purchase orders weren't let. And he goes, well, I won't even say it on the air, but he was very explicit that he was going to get a general that was sitting outside while this phone call was going on into the matter right away. And within a few days, money started to be released for armored vehicles. This was in January. And then Senator Kennedy called and he says, you know, George Bush told me he's going to get equipment. And I went down to D.C. when the budget came out for FY, which would be FY4. And Senator Kennedy says, there's money in this budget for armor and body armor. You wait and see. And when the budget came out, there was zero incremental money for body armor and only 800 armored Humvees. I went ballistic. I decided that was the point where I realized that, politics aside, the soldiers, the American public was being lied to about what the country could actually produce. And from that day until Rumsfeld's speech, we went after him with everything we had for one reason, and it was to make people aware that not enough money was being spent on armor and soldiers. And it became a very embarrassing thing, and a supplemental was put together in April, and it was passed in August, and Alma and I thought the deal was done. We could stop work on this because we'd won.
And Alma, I understand that that to this day you still get letters and messages from family members and troops thanking you for the work that you did getting those vehicles out there. What do they tell you?
Well, well, the letters go mostly to Brian. Of course, he earned it. But, you know, quite often it's from a parent that's just grateful. We just got one where the woman said her son was somewhere in the middle of March, had been in an explosion, and she just wanted to say, thank you for making it a day for us to celebrate, not a day to mourn.
We come to a conclusion that, you know, what we did or what people did with us didn't matter, but then you get a letter like that, and you realize that, well, in fact, it still does, and it did at the time. And, you know, it morphed, though. It became radio jammers and then single-handed tourniquets and blood clotting agents. I mean, the Army could have reduced casualties by 15% by issuing single-handed tourniquets.
Alma, can I ask you another quick question?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a little earlier, very humbly, that most of the work regarding the armoring of the vehicles was done by Brian. But you've also done work as well, I mean, reaching out to other families, Gold Star families, for example, who've lost loved ones in this war. Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
When it immediately happens, the whole community is there, and everyone's around you, and everybody loves you. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, they're on with their lives, and you're still trying to, you know, get over the shock. So we try and bond with each other and say, no, really, you're doing fine. It is this awful. It's just really, really hard. What I choose to focus on, to spend my time on, rather than, you know, feeling sorry for myself, we have a lot of wounded soldiers and Marines coming home. Traumatic brain injury and PTSD are very serious problems. We have amputees, and I want the rest of America to know they're here and they need us.
There's also the very fact that the war itself continues and we still have men and women serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that they remain, you know, on the front lines and in danger. And I wonder, Brian, if I can actually also ask you about your continuing work. You actually were inspired to start a company that builds
unmanned ground vehicles.
Meaning?
Robots.
Robots that are actually out in the field in Iraq doing what?
Well, ours are just now moving through the acceptance process.
What inspired you to found a company that builds robots?
Well, actually, it was with my brother, who's a product designer, Richard Hart. In 05, April, we saw a Lance Corporal push a car bomb off of a road with his armored Humvee, and both vehicles exploded in a fireball. In fact, millions of people saw it on TV. And the armor of the Humvee protected the Lance Corporal, but his vehicle was destroyed. And we thought that was the unbelievable, most stupidest way we could ever think of moving, identifying car bombs. And that day we founded what became Black Eye Robotics, which is a small but successful company that makes unmanned ground vehicles to probe and to deal with car bombs. That's our specialty, is car bombs.
So these robots, once they will be sometime in the future deployed into the field, say...
Well, they are here at Logan, for example, okay, and with the Navy, but they're...
So they can be... They're remotely controlled by an operator, and they go towards the potential bomb.
Yeah.
And what do they do when they arrive there?
Well, first they interrogate the situation, find out what if there's a bomb. And then there are techniques, often using water charges, to destroy... The car, knocked the wires, the radios, the batteries away from the explosives before the bomb is set off.
You know, in hearing you say that, and hearing your continued dedication, both in the company that you founded, in the lobbying that you do, in the work that you, Alma, have done with other families, you know, it occurs to me that there are many thousands of families who have gone through what you've experienced, losing a loved one. And it's very understandable that many of them have and just might want to say, I just want to deal with this on my own in my community. I don't want to be an advocate. I don't want to lobby. I just want to try and go on with my life the best way that I can. No one would blame them for that. And yet you two kind of took the other path, which is one of, you know, you were out in public, you were lobbying, you were doing all this work. You're still doing it today. You're gracious enough to be here with us. Why do you think you took that route?
Well, right up front, first of all, it's easy for us to stand up and say, yes, our son stood up, fired his weapon, protected his buddies, and got shot. He died with his boots on. It would be another thing. I know families where, you know, he bled out for 11 hours until the medics ran out of blood to give him, where the Humvee exploded and he was thrown from the wreckage and he crawled back and tried to pull another guy out of the flaming Humvee and they both died waiting for help. I wouldn't be up here talking about that. Some things are too painful.
Well, you know, we received that haunting phone call, you know, where he asked for help. And he also asked us in a letter that came to us after he was dead to find two of his friends that had been seriously wounded and were at Walter Reed. And it was from those experiences that we began to get involved with the work with wounded veterans.
Alma and Brian Hart, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for this opportunity to share the stories, not just ours, but every family story.
Yes, I mean, there are 5,000 Gold Star families out there today that need to be remembered and acknowledged, and we just thank you for the opportunity.
We have to take a break, but when we come back...
I know that Uncle Dick was a rear gunner, and he was shot down. He was Mom's favorite uncle, and that's about all I know.
The family of Lieutenant Richard Loring learned a lot more about their Uncle Dick after his remains were finally brought back home to Massachusetts 6 decades after he was killed in World War II. That story and more on this Memorial Day when we return. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.